Welcome back to another episode of Pilcrow and Dagger the Shorts. My name is Amory Silver, and I'll be joining you today as we listen to Cora's Eyes by H.R. Boldwood. But first, a few announcements. Submissions for the November-December issue are now closed. We are currently accepting submissions for the January issue. The theme for this issue is The Survivor. Have you ever been trapped on a desert island? Survived a plane crash? Survived the in-laws? Tell us all about it. The deadline for this issue is November 26th. Be sure to check us out on the web. We're giving our blog a whole new look by publishing how-tos on using social media, creating memes, and even making GIFs. Stop by at pilcrowdagger.com/tutorials for more information. Don't miss out. Be sure to sign up for our newsletter so you can be the first to receive this information. And now, I proudly present Cora's Eyes by H.R. Boldwood. October 16th, 1782, Baltimore. Dearest Margaret, would that I could be seated next to you upon our old porch swing, laughing at one of Papa's childhood tales, or reminiscing of better times. In truth, my heart aches for Papa's loss, and I yearn for your companionship more with each passing day. Regrettably, my search for employment in this masculine world has taken much longer than anticipated. It is apparent that by virtue of my sex, I am considered to be devoid of skill, absent of thought, and incapable of sound judgment, making it all the more astounding, given such gross ineptitude, that I am finally able to report some wonderful news. The gods have smiled upon me. I have secured employment, albeit in such a dark and curious place. All that seems to be is not. Deep beneath the brilliant gardens and polished exterior of Sutphin Manor lurks a baleful disposition. Despite the valiant efforts of its owner, the dismal tenor that dwells within its bricks and mortar lingers like an unseen pall. No doubt Irving Jeffries was a dashing man once, tall and lean with emerald eyes, eyes now consumed by sorrow. Mrs. Abbott, the manor cook, confided in me that his wife died in childbirth some 6 years back. Meager as suitable employment opportunities have been, I must confess to a disposition of absolute giddiness when Jeffries hired me as a governess to his charming daughter, Anna. Had my search for a position continued much longer, I might have been living hand to mouth on the streets. Mrs. Abbott advised that although Jeffries hails from New York, he has settled in Baltimore to start anew. Idle talk among the help suggests that he purchased the manor for a song at auction. He busies himself with renovations, finishing first one room, then bounding to the next like a man hoping to escape the clutches of abject sorrow. Just yesterday, Jeffries requested my assistance in tidying the attic, ridding it of a past he neither knew nor cared to preserve, save any hidden treasure my woman's eye might catch. Anna and I will fill this loft with our own past, he'd said. Chased by the echo of our footsteps, we entered the tomb-like alcove and worked our way through the cobwebs and the cloying mustiness. A vague uneasiness took hold. Goose flesh rose on the nape of my neck. At length, we came upon a weathered wooden trunk that was chained and padlocked. What have we here that requires such protection? He asked. Mayhap, we have stumbled upon a prize. Unable to gain entry without tools, he left, but soon returned with an axe. After chopping through the locks and chains, he pried open the lid. It fit snugly on the swollen trunk, causing it to creak and groan like a set of old bones. A sickly sweet odor wafted through the air, the odor of decay. A strange assortment of religious relics lay scattered atop a tattered quilt that shrouded the object within. Wasting no time, he threw the quilt aside. "Merciful heavens!" I whispered, crossing myself. Jeffries laughed and raised the object for closer inspection. "How perfectly hideous!" In his hand was a doll with a ruffled nightcap resting atop the crown of its head, and a nightshirt covering its body. But, sweet Margaret, do not doubt me when I say that never in the history of doll-making had a tinker crafted a doll so malignant-looking. Waist-length auburn coils framed a porcelain face that culminated in a decidedly pointed chin. Its features were pinched and severe, its mouth unsmiling, but what gave the doll its malevolent countenance were a pair of large black voids where its eyes should have been. Surely gauged upon its appearance, some wicked fate had befallen it. Jeffries tossed the doll into the rubbish heap. Why would anyone keep this aberration, let alone safeguard it with padlocks and chains? Why indeed? It lay atop the pile, positioned such that its blackened orbs appeared to follow me. I flung the tattered quilts from the trunk or the doll, blocking those relentless empty sockets, and then continued with my duties. I gave the matter no further thought until the following day, when Mr. Jeffries followed me into the study and closed the pocket door behind us. His lips were taut, his eyes narrow. Miss McGowan, why did you give that heinous corpse of a doll to Anna? Sir, I did no such thing, I assure you. None of the other staff knew the doll existed, Miss McGowan. Anna has no one on this earth, save me, and now you. If I have mistakenly judged your suitability for this position, it is best that I know now. I would not lie to you, sir. I have come to look upon Anna as my own. My heart ached at the possibility of losing such a treasured thing, all for the gifting of a doll, a gifting in which I had played no part. There came a tiny knock upon the door. Jeffrey slid it back to find Anna, eyes dancing, clutching the disfigured doll against her chest. There you are, Miss Emma. I wanted to introduce you to my new dolly, Cora. I stooped to meet her gaze. Such a lonely-looking dolly. Wherever did she come from? She was rocking in my dolly chair when I woke this morning. Isn't she grand? Despite the thing's wicked appearance, Anna was drawn to it and took it under her wing as if it were a wounded bird. Dear Margaret, I knew not what to think of her attachment to this grotesque Moppet, yet I hadn't the heart to take it from her. Neither could I rid myself of the disquiet that came from wondering how it had found its way into Anna's arms. This place portends such mystery. When next my missive finds you, perhaps I shall be able to say that my concerns had been for naught. Your loving sister, Emma. October 30th, 1782, Baltimore. Sweet Margaret, would that I could report that the fears plaguing me were unwarranted. Both father and child mired deeper into a roiling pool of despair. Anna's skin has grown pallid, her eyes hollow. She is inseparable from that doll, even insisting that a place be set for it at mealtime. Anna has gone so far as to lay her own infant bunting in her toy cradle, as if Cora were a real babe. Torn between indulging a lonely child and rescuing her from the precipice of fantasy, Mrs. Abbott and I still are tongues. But any indecision on Mr. Jeffrey's part disappeared when Anna asked, "Daddy, which color eyes are best?" "Without a doubt, my love, your blue eyes are my favorite, so like your mother's they are." Curled snugly in his lap, she took his face in her tiny hands and peered up at him. "Cora says she wants green eyes like yours, Daddy." His back stiffened, though his tone remained neutral. "Anna, darling, you know that dolls cannot speak. Why must you pretend so?" "But, Daddy, Cora does speak." "I have never heard her." With a nod, he enjoined me to follow suit. "Nor have I, Anna. Perhaps she speaks to you in your dreams." "She only speaks when we are alone," Anna said. "She says you do not like her, Daddy. Is that so?" He shifted and sighed. "Why don't you give me Cora, and I will bring you a pretty new dolly from town." He reached for the doll, but Anna began to wail. He rose to his feet and lowered her to the floor. "There, there. Take Cora and go play in your room now, my dear. Miss Emma and I have grown-up things to discuss." He closed the door behind her before speaking again. The child is much too attached to that monstrosity, to the point of losing perspective. Tonight, when she is asleep, I will dispose of it once and for all. I do not wish to see it reappear. Am I understood? I blanched. Of course. But you must believe me, sir. Neither I nor any staff member gave her the doll. More's the pity, Miss McGowan, for then by some unknown means that doll has defied the laws of natural order. There is something unsettling about that thing. He left me in the study and went to town to run his errand. Late that evening, while Anna slumbered, I watched Jeffrey steal across her room and take the thing from its cradle. In its place, he left a beautiful new doll with golden curls, a cherubic face, and innocent azure eyes. He carried Cora outside to the water well. Without so much as a moment's hesitation, he threw the abomination into the void and did not leave until he heard the telltale splashing of water. He returned, looking unburdened, as if a tremendous weight had been lifted from him. The manor itself seemed to breathe, as if freed from the crush of some malevolent force. Good sister, could that doll be the albatross that plagues Sutphit Manor, the source of its ill humor? Pray that this act of a father's love has driven the darkness away. With deepest affection, Emma. October 31st, 1782, Baltimore. Dearest sister, so quickly hope fades. In the blink of an eye, Anna has wasted to a shadow, and her eyes have lost their shine. She awoke to find Cora gone, replaced by the sweet-faced cherub chosen by her father, and became inconsolable, beseeching us to find her baby. My heart near beat its last when through a veil of tears she whimpered that Cora was wet and cold. Anna's eyes grew suddenly wide. She pummeled her tiny fists against her father's chest. "You did this, Daddy. You threw her into the well. Why were you so mean to Cora? Why?" My eyes met Jeffrey's, and we seemed to exchange a single thought. How could she have known? It pained us to watch Anna grieve. Nothing we did or said could appease her. She spent the day pining in her room, unwilling to speak or eat. She peered out of her window and slept sporadically, only to awaken in renewed torrents of tears. At dusk, racked by exhaustion, she settled into a peaceful sleep. Fearful that melancholy would swallow her whole, we resigned to monitor her throughout the night and enlisted the aid of Mrs. Abbott, who fed us tea and kept vigil with us. At the midnight hour, we made once again for her room. The stillness split from the peal of a child's giggle. But it was not Anna's infectious titter. It was a cackle, maniacal and taunting. We raced to her room. Jeffrey stood in the doorway, peering into the darkness. I followed his gaze, first to the rocking chair and then to the cradle, each of us breathing a sigh of relief, having found no sign of the doll. We then turned to Anna's bed. There she slept the deep, carefree sleep of innocence, breathing steadily, with Cora's long auburn coils round loosely around her throat. The malignant monster pursed its pinched mouth and loosed its fiendish voice for all to hear.
"Shush, Daddy. Your baby is sleeping."
Jeffreys raced toward the bed. "Get away from her, demon!" It cackled again, but its coils slithered free of Anna's neck. Jeffreys hurriedly scooped his sleeping daughter against his chest and snatched her away from the cursed doll. With a gentle kiss to her forehead, he placed her into my arms and said, "We are all she has. Take her. I beg you, protect her with your life." I carried her outside, absent the fray, and stood transfixed by what next occurred. Jeffreys followed me through the door, the evil dog clutched in his hands. A fierce wind funneled outward from the manor. Trees tore asunder, branches, twigs, and leaves took flight, trapping Jeffreys in a vortex of whirling debris. His words barely audible above the din. "Leave this place, hellhound. Return to the flames that spawned you." The demon doll burst forth an angry howl, polluting the air with a fetid stench. It shone a grisly smile and simpered in a child's falsetto.
"Cora wants green eyes, Daddy."
A menacing growl followed. Jeffrey stood his ground. "Come and get them, hag." The cacophony reached a crescendo. The air pressure dropped, threatening to burst my ears. Still I stayed, mesmerized as Jeffreys produced a flask from his pocket. So surprised was I at his timing for a nip that an incredulous laugh near escaped me until he threw the liquid at the demon, and its smell belied my fears. The demon moved to and fro, dancing out of reach. Jeffreys launched forward and latched onto the beast, It yowled and hissed when he produced a match from his pocket. "Mr. Jeffries, no, please," I screamed. "Think of your daughter." With a tortured look, he said, "But I am," and struck his match against the cobblestone. The kerosene ignited. Both he and the demon Cora blazed into flames. I turned away, sobbing, blocking their screams from my mind, thankful that Anna's exhaustion had left her oblivious to the evil doings of the night. With that, dear sister, there is little more to say. I am all that Anna has in this world. She asks for her father daily, and strangely has no recollection of Cora. For now, I smile and tell her that her father is away. How am I to explain his passing, when the truth defies imagination? Sutphen Manor is a desolate pit that holds no future for us. We shall journey on toward a new beginning. Pray, kind sister, for prosperity and hope. All my love, Emma. December 1st, 1782, Tocinton. Dear sweet Margaret, Anna and I are safely ensconced in Tocinton, far enough, God willing, that the nightmarish memories will soon begin to fade. At present, we survive on God's good humor, but now I am responsible for us both, and my search for employment must begin anew. I pray that my shoulders will not be considered too slender to be tested. Mrs. Abbott was kind enough to forward our belongings. She praised the manor sells quickly, so that she might retain her cook's position, and she vows that the unholy events of the night will be taken to her grave. Whilst unboxing our possessions, I took care to ensure Anna was otherwise preoccupied, a shrewd and prophetic decision. My heart sickened at the sight of a familiar tattered quilt. Gathering my courage, I grasped its edges and slowly folded it back, to find that Cora had returned. Her porcelain skin was cracked and peeled, no doubt due to the licking of the flames on that tragic night. I marveled at the bottomless black eye sockets staring back at me. They were proof that Cora had not succeeded in stealing the emerald eyes of Irving Jeffries. Failing all else, I had learned that evil never dies. At best, it is held in abeyance. I wrapped the doll in its tattered quilt and placed it in a sturdy trunk, entombed beneath vials of holy water and sanctified relics. Satisfied the demon had been neutralized, I closed the lid and applied both chains and padlocks. Under cover of night, I returned to Sutphen Manor, hauling the trunk by buckboard. Mrs. Abbott and I buried it deep in an unmarked grave, well concealed from unsuspecting victims. There, the demon would be trapped for all eternity, never again to see the light of day. Such was the plan I followed, such was the plan that affords me sleep, lest I toss and turn in the dark of night, wondering when the demon will return to claim new eyes for Cora. I must retire for the night, dear sister. Recent events have taken their toll. My mirror tells me that there is tired gray skin requiring rest, and that in order to sleep away the darkness, my own green eyes must close. Emma.
Cora wants green eyes, Daddy.
That concludes episode 31 of Pilcro and Daggers the Shorts. You've just finished listening to Cora's Eyes by H.R. Boldwood. Special thanks to Kevin MacLeod for letting us use his songs Come Play With Me and Happy Boy End Theme. Both of his songs are licensed under Creative Commons by 3.0 and can be found on his website at incompetech.com. All other sound effects are courtesy of freesound.org. Thank you for joining us. My name is Amory Silver, and I'll see you next time.